Hello everyone. Welcome to the Strong Gravity seminar this week. The speaker today is Pauline Chen from UC Riverside. As you might have noticed, Pauline and his collaborators has posted a paper on archive several weeks ago about a very important problem in general relativity regarding the definition of angular momentum and infinity. So it's known that angular momentum is not invariant under these super translation operations at infinity. And Pauline's paper points out an important step towards a super translation invariant definition of angular momentum. Yeah, Pauline, please take it away.
Thank Juan for the introduction and also for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to speak at the Parameter Institute, although it's virtually. Hopefully, we can be physically visit there soon. Okay, so we will talk about angular momentum in general relativity, particularly at non-infinity. And the question we want to focus on is sort of the how this transform under a super translation, which is a sort of, so we know at the now infinity, the symmetric group, usually the from the Poincaré group, it sort of enhanced to the von D. Messmer's Sachs group, which contain, in addition to the Poincaré group, a infinite dimensional super translation. Now, in many situations, this is a very useful and interesting feature at now infinity. You get, for this additional symmetry, you get additional charges, soft pairs to the black hole, if you will. But on the other hand, it sort of also give rise to some difficulties, in particular if you want to ask about, well, if you have some sort of event of gravitational radiation, like merge of two black holes, for example, and it's natural to ask, well, how much energy and angular momentums are sort of radiated away in such a event. As we will see shortly, that this super translation sort of introduce an ambiguity on this, well, very natural question to ask, which is how much sort of angular momentum in particular is carried away in a gravitational radiation. Okay? So there are sort of classical, well, first of all, well, now infinity, there are sort of different ways to describe now infinity. The particular we will be using will be in terms of this von D. Sachs coordinates. Other approaches, for example, Penrose diagram or conformal compactifications. But we'll focus on now infinity, which has the von D. coordinates. And sort of in this case, there is a sort of a classical definition of angular momentum. We'll first sort of quantify what exactly is this super translation ambiguity when you talk about the sort of total change of angular momentum. And then you will introduce a new definition of angular momentum at non-infinity, which is free from such ambiguity. So the work I will describe today will be joint work with Jordan Kaler, Mutao Wang, Yekai Wang, and Xinzhong Yao. Okay, so let's begin with, well, how we will describe non-infinity using the von D. coordinate. Right, so this is a sort of a coordinate system of non-infinity, right, of this particular form of coordinate R U and R, and then a coordinate x2, x3 on the sphere. And the metric is of this particular form. And one should know that in this case, DDR is a null vector, and U equals to constant psi is a null cone, which has the degenerate metric R squared HAB. Okay, so the level set for U is a null cone, where DDR is a null generator along this null cone. Okay. And specifically, we request that the, well, it's, we want to describe asymptotically flat space-time, and certainly the Minkowski space would be described by flat metric, and because space can be written in this form, where this is the standard unit round metric on X2. So really U and V, if our asymptotic flatness should goes to one, and this vector should decays to zero at a suitable rate. And after factoring the I squared, this should start with the flat metric. Okay, so we are imposing such asymptotic at infinity. And also there's also an additional outgoing, no outgoing radiation condition so that the determinant of HAB is the same as the, so the volume element is the same as the determinant of the standard metric. Okay. Particularly this means that this part is a traceless symmetric two tensor. Okay, so this is the basic ansatz. And the nice thing about this is, well, we want to consider general relativity. So particularly the Einstein vector equation that the Ricci curvature of this metric G is equals to zero. This is a system of nonlinear wave equation. The nice thing about such ansatz is that it sort of reduces it to family of ordinary differential equation or sort of nested set of ordinary differential equations. So how this work is on a, you know, one should think of this as a initial data, right? The Einstein equation will become a ODS in R, which determine the metric completely in terms of the following data that one can choose freely. So first of all, is the metric on X2. And once you choose that, then you get an radial ODEs of U, for example, which determine U completely. Then you get, once U and HAB are determined, you get a radial ODE for WA, which determine WA completely, except a constant of integration NA that is called the angular momentum aspect. We will see why this is called this later on. And then there's a ODE in R, which determine V, again, up to this constant of integration, M, which is called the mass aspect. So on a, now call everything is completely determined if one choose HAB, but this depends on both R and X. This depends on just X, no R dependence. This also just depends on X. Okay, so this determines the initial data. Well, it's a wave equation, so once we choose the initial data, we also need to know, well, how the data evolve under the Einstein equation. And specifically, all the evolution is information is captured in the derivative of the leading, well, the first non-trivial term of the induced metric, AB. So all the information is capturing here. And again, you can choose this NAB freely. This is depend on U and X. You can choose this freely. Once this is chosen, everything else is determined. Indeed, the two free data, well, the three free data are determined by what you have on the cone and this choice of NAB. So specifically, the mass aspect evolved like this. The angular momentum aspect evolved like this. And so now the particular format doesn't matter, but sort of at least the hierarchy is important, that you have the free data that you can choose. And once you have that, then the Einstein equation determines everything else pretty much as an ODE. And that's also a formula.
Sorry, but you also need either regularity condition somewhere or some other non-surface, otherwise you don't complete the data this way, right?
Well, I guess I sort of, so you sort of need a, data like this to determine the evolution here. And I mean, how to put data on this on some large radius are sort of reflect by this. Is that what you were?
So you say that again, so I didn't get that. So on just give a given null hypersurface, and right, you're going to give C. You're saying if you're going to specify N on that on the incoming null surface?
Right.
And you're saying that's all?
Well, no, we're just going to specify H, M, and N on a incoming null hyper. We're going to specify this on an incoming null hypersurface. Now, these are actually, strictly speaking, correspond to specifying data on a path-directed null cone in some region. But you can sort of put this at infinity if you just want to solve it near infinity a little bit. So,
okay.
Strictly speaking, you have to specify data, this data here, and specify some data on a null cone in the opposite direction. But these are sort of reduced to this if you look at close enough to infinity. But if you want a well-posed Einstein equation, you should be specifying data on two null cones, one outgoing and one incoming. Okay. And yeah, so there's a data of this that we would write it down. But not just complicated, but we will not be using it here. Okay. So this is the sort of brief review of the boundary coordinate and how it breaks down, this hierarchy breaks down the Einstein equation into sort of a something you can deal with reasonably, like a sort of family of ordinary differential equations. Now, such hierarchy, I mean, we're specifically using the bounded Sox coordinate system, but this head hierarchy also will also show up in other, many other approaches as well, in one form or another. Like, for example, in the work of the formation of black hole in by Christodoulou, using double null foliations to solve Einstein equation, again, similar hierarchy shows up. There's a main data, which is like essentially this that you have to prescribe on a outgoing null cone, and a few more data that you prescribe on a smaller subset that doesn't depend on R. Okay. Now, so for each sort of level set U, want to associate conserved quantities. So the first one is probably the energy and linear momentum. So now it's just a bit of notation. So R at equals to infinity will be sort of the future null infinity, square plus, we're going to this surface. And you, if you set R equals to infinity, this will have a degenerate metric, which is just, after taking the limit, just the sigma AB. So the future now in infinity is also equipped with a degenerate metric. It's also a, so now cone itself equipped with this, that metric. Okay, so one immediate observation is that instead of consider U equals to constant, in fact, you can take any cross section, U equals to some function of theta and phi. Because of this metric is degenerate, you get the same metric, whatever level set you look at. So the, any cross-section U equals to F of theta phi you look at null infinity, it's going to be wrong and sort of, in some sense, indistinguishable from level set of U. I mean, you choose a particular coordinate so that you see U as a level set, but in other coordinate, this might be a level set for another coordinate system. We'll come back to this more explicitly when we talk about the super transition. But for that cut U equals to constant, cut the energy and momentum are given by the, well, mass as a function, integrates against either the constant or against the standard coordinate functions. Coordinates of unit sphere. And this is why M is called the mass aspect, because integral against the constant and the first eigen functions give you the energy momentum. Okay. Now, well, again, we're interested in radiation, how much, for example, energy is radiated away. So I want to know if I have a future null infinity complete from space infinity to future time infinity to describe a gravitational black hole merger or other gravitational radiations. Well, how much energy is carried away? So I need to know, well, how does this change when I change U? But before that, let's talk about the BMS group and the super translation. Okay, so, well, we have a coordinate system. So what is the isentropic symmetry group? You know, we know that, well, isentropic symmetry group corresponds, symmetry will correspond to conserved quantities. So if you want to study conserved quantity, then isentropic symmetry group will be important. Now, usually the Minkowski space, the symmetry group is the Poincaré group. Translation in time and space, rotation and boost, that's 10-dimensional. Now, at the null infinity, this is enhanced to the BMS group, which contain not just the Poincaré group, but also the super translation. So these are the BMS group, these are sort of coordinate transformations at null infinity, which keep the bounded set coordinate form. And you have the usual 10-dimensional Poincaré group with 10 translations, space translation, rotation, and boost, right? There's one here, three space translation here, three rotations, and three boost. Right. And super translation is an infinite dimensional group. This is a change of coordinate. At infinity, it looks like the following. Suppose I have two coordinate systems, u bar x bar and ux. It sends u bar to u bar plus a function of x and send x bar to x. And important is it's not just a map at null infinity, actually extend into your space time. So in other words, suppose this is the, now come I started with, I have the coordinate u, r, theta phi here. Here's the u level set, u equals to constant. This is null infinity, r equals to infinity. I have, after a super translation, u bar, r bar, and still theta phi since on the S2 have a, but instead of cutting at u equals to constant, I will be cutting at some graph like this, and still have a, we're now cone. Okay. And here I can describe in this bounded coordinate here, both of these are bounded coordinate systems. Here I have GUU, GUR, and so on and so forth, right? Determined by the data C and M and MA. Equally on this side, I will have in G, but in the coordinate U bar, bar, and so on and so forth. Okay, and with which determined by the data, B, the shear, mu's, and MA. Okay. So both are valid bounded coordinate systems because the BMS group are transformation which respect the form of the bounded coordinate system. So both are equally valid bounded coordinate systems. There's no preferred bounded coordinate system, particularly when you have radiations. So this would be, we'll see that this is sort of the source where the ambiguity comes from. Okay. Now let's look at, well, how much energy is radiated away. For this, let's suppose this non-infinity extend from space like infinity, u equals to negative infinity, to time like future time like infinity, u equals to positive infinity. And we can sort of famous bounding mass loss formula. tell us that, well, the derivative of the bounding energy, the bounding energy is the integral of m, and in differentiate m in u, you get the first term, which is the negative 1a of n squared, plus a double divergence term, which vanish when you integrate on x2. So follow directly from the definition of the bounding energy and the evolution for the mass aspect, that if you differentiate mass, you get this negative, well, non-positive term. So it sort of tell you that the bounding energy is always decreasing. So it's sort of a theoretical verification of radiation, that your energy is decreasing. In particular, you can you can sort of tell the change of energy from space like infinity to future like infinity is the amount of energy radiated away. So we define delta E as E at infinity minus E at negative infinity, right? So this is the final energy at future timeline infinity. This is the initial energy at space like infinity, right? The difference is the amount of energy radiated away. That is a reasonable candidate for that. And in terms of the, can write this as an integral. Oops, forgot a factor of 4. You take the difference, you integrate the derivative to get the difference. So it's going to be, you can write down as an integral like this on the whole square plus of minus 1 over 4 n squared. Okay. Okay, so so far so good. But remember, we mentioned that there's no preferred bounding coordinate system. We compute this that we think is a good candidate for the total energy radiated away in a coordinate u. What happened? We apply a super translation f and look at a different coordinate u bar. If this really capture the amount of energy radiated away, I can do the same computation in the coordinate u bar. Denote that result by this after a super translation by f to my coordinate. I should get the same answer if this really give us the energy radiated away. We should have this equality. Otherwise, this delta E is not a good notion of how much energy is radiated away, because you don't have a preferred coordinate system. And if you apply a coordinate transformation, delta E goes to some other value, then it's not. That doesn't really tell us how much energy is radiated away. Okay? So we need to, well, see whether this is true or not. And if it's not true, how much is the difference? How does it depend on f? And for energy, this is in fact equal. But again, this is, you have to, well, an easier way to look at this is, well, first of all, we need to understand how does the data, CAB and NA and M, how do they transform under super translation? In fact, the new tensor NAB, they transform sort of simplest, almost like a invariance under, you just, if you want to evaluate N bar at U bar, you just evaluate NAB at U bar plus F, then you get the new in the bar coordinate. Now for the shear tensor CAB, it's slightly more complicated. You evaluate C bar at U bar, you get, well, the term that you expect, CAB at U bar plus F, but then you get this linear but second derivative in terms of F. Okay. Again, this is for a translation of this form, U equals to U bar plus F of X. But the mass aspect itself transform even more complicated. You have the term you expected. There's this some term which depend on the divergence of the news, further one more derivative of the news, and also, sorry, it should be just plus NAB and some two derivative of F, a quadratic of F here. So the mass transform quite complicated, well, more complicated than news and shear. So in order to show this, one way you can look at is, well, again, we have in the U coordinate, we compute delta E this way. We can do the same thing in the U bar coordinate. So in the U bar coordinate, it will be the same integral, but with n replaced by m bar. Now, because n and m bars are related by this, so in fact, it's a simple change of coordinate, which is exactly this, to show that these two integrals are the same. Okay, so this will follow from this formula, and plus change of variables. Of course, you need sort of suitable decay for the news to make sure that these integrals are finite, and you can apply the change of variable formula in a sort of improper integral, but those are not particularly important. Right, but basically, one can show that if you look at a coordinate u bar, then delta E computed in u coordinate and the delta E computed in the u bar coordinate are the same after you do any super translation. So this gives us more confidence that indeed delta E captured the amount of energy radiated away in a gravitational radiation. Okay, with this, now we can turn to, well, how about angular momentum? Want to know how much angular momentum is radiated away as well. Now, the definition of angular momentum is turned out to be more subtle. The different approaches, Hamiltonian approach, spinner, twisters, and so on. So switch these to, well, not necessarily different definition, but well, I mean, first of all, if you use different ways to describe non-infinity, Carmel convification rather than bounded side coordinate systems, then, I mean, you can only talk about whether the definition is the same or not when a particular space has both structure. And in a lot of cases, it's not even clear which space has which structures or not. So it's a little tricky to say whether these are the same definition or not if you use different approach to describe non-infinity. But in the case where you have an actual bounded coordinate, and then a lot of this definition would agree. And certainly in important example like curved space time, they will agree with what you would expect. Okay. Now, since we have particular interest in the bounded coordinate, so let's use this definition of Drake's rule, which also used the same sort of the bounded coordinate systems, and take it as sort of the classical definition of angular momentum using the bounded coordinate system. Again, most other definition, assuming there's a bounded coordinate system, a lot of this definition would be agreeing with this one. So we're looking at angular momentum. So you're looking at the rotation Killing field, y, and you integrate this against the main term is the angular momentum aspect, and then plus this quadratic expression of the shear tensor. And again, at integrate on x2, then you get a function of u, which also depending on the rotation Killing field. But sometimes later when we fix a particular rotation Killing field, just for simplicity of notation, let's just write it as j tilde of u. Okay. So, well, we want to sort of do the same thing. First, look at how this evolves when we change u. Integrate this to get sort of a delta j, and ask, well, is this delta j invariant under a super translation? So from the evolution of the angular momentum aspect and also the shear, this you can do sort of a straightforward, although kind of lengthy computation to compute the derivative of the classical angular momentum. The following, again, so still, instead of when we differentiate the energy, you have a quadratic in the news. Now you have still quadratic, but one factor is the shear, the other factor is the news. It doesn't have structure. And also derivative is involved. Now we can simply define delta of the total change of the angular momentum, that is in the u coordinate of the classical angular momentum. This is j tilde at timeline infinity, future timeline infinity minus j tilde at spatial infinity. Again, we have the derivative to just integrate the differentiation and write this as an integral on square plus as follows. Again, in the u, in a particular boundary coordinate system u. No, for the angular momentum, very early on, people sort of know that this might not be invariant under supertranslation. And it's pointed out by many people, including, for example, Penrose in his 1982 sort of lecture note on open problems in mathematical in general relativity. So point this out. Okay, it's sort of this worry that the angular momentum can be shifted away by the supertranslation, and particularly might be difficult to discuss questions such as angular momentum carried away by gravitational radiation. So in the context that we already discussed, you can just say that, well, if I start with a coordinate ux, a related coordinate u bar x bar, which is different by supertranslation by f, would this delta j tilde computed in the u coordinate and the j tilde computed in the u bar coordinate, whether they will be the same or not? And if they're not the same, then one should think of this difference as sort of the ambiguity of the total change of angular momentum. I mean, this is the ambiguity that we don't want. Certainly at each particular ju, because you're looking at different cars, so certainly ju or ju bar for a particular u value, they naturally they might not be the same. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the total change, one would hope that this would be invariant under supertranslation. Otherwise, yes?
Lorraine has a question. Yeah.
Okay. Hi. Hello, Chen. So I agree with what you're saying here, that there's this ambiguity, but I'm not sure why this is such a big surprise or a big problem, in the sense that you go back to special relativity. If you define the notion of angular momenta, of course, it depends on the choice of the translational frame. Or if you define the notion of energy, it depends on the choice of frame. So of course, when you know, if you have two different observers at different point or different time that measure angular momenta, even in special relativity, if they don't communicate that they're in the same frame of reference, then it's going to matter.
Yeah, so
I mean, you know, so I think here, yeah, what you're talking is angular momenta. The invariant notion is not the angular momenta, it's called the spin, and you have the Pauli-Lubansky formula. So, right, it's not, I mean, I think you agree with that, but it, just to confuse, it's not like a big problem or a new problem, it's just called, it's the problem of relativity, that these are only relative observable and not absolute observable.
Certainly, if you took at two finite regions, and certainly they might not be the same, but first of all, we're talking about the difference at sort of initial and final state. And also, yes, if you sort of. I forgot to mention this, but thank you for finishing up, because I forgot to mention this. So maybe when I introduced the super translation, I said that it's sort of two separate things. But actually, as you point out correctly, the lower mode for F, the 0 mode and 1 mode for the super translation indeed correspond to time translation and spatial translation. So those ambiguity is fine, because you sort of know that if you just translate your center, then your angular momentum change by delta x cross the linear momentum, for example. And so that is sort of reasonable. But the higher mode of F, you don't want ambiguity on that.
Okay, I understand that somehow you want to define a notion of spin, which is different from angular momenta, but the fact that the notion of angular momenta or the notion of energy depends on the reference frame, I think it's okay. What has changed in gravity is that the notion of reference frame is not just a global reference frame, you have to specify the supertranslation reference, right? So that's what the notion of symmetry is bigger, and therefore the notion of relativity or reference frame is bigger. But once you accept that translation or analogy, it's, I mean, the discussion you're having is very similar if you read papers from the 1920s about relativistic angular momenta. People were, you know, the analog of Penrose there was confused for the same reason.
But isn't, sorry, Laura, is this what they are trying to do here? It's just something a lot less, I don't know, ambitious than that. I just want to say the full angular momentum radiated from I naught to I plus should be the same measure by any observer that lives forever and is accounting for this. So at any given cut, you might measure different amounts of angular momentum. But if I ask, what's the total angular momentum I radiated from beginning to end? That's what they're trying to see if it is unique.
Well, is that right? I would say, yeah, I would say, and that cannot be done. What can be done is define a notion of spin. So I think maybe it's a question of terminology. What you're looking for is the difference between angular momenta and the Pauli-Lubansky vector, which is the, or it's the same thing, you know, there's one, or let's say, think about the energy versus the mass. The energy is not invariant under, you know, boosts, but the mass is. So, you know, anytime you have a symmetry, there's a notion of charges, which is not invariant under the change of frame. And then the notion of angular momenta depends on your reference frame. I mean, that's just a fact. It's not a big deal. It's not, the notion of spin, it's different. So maybe that's, I'm trying to just be as a, you know, put a different spin on it. I think the project of having invariant object, it's, does that make sense? The difference between spin and angular momenta? Or the difference between energy and mass?
Right, but, right? I mean, certainly there's a, right, you have, but we're talking about one single bounded coordinate here. Certainly, I mean, if you don't have a single coordinate system covering from I minus to I plus, then certainly how you identify them, the field would be important. But in this case, we do have one single coordinate which cover all the way from time, mm-hmm. spatial infinity to timeline infinities. And also, I don't think it's a question of choosing a different, how you identify the rotation killing fields.
It's not about, yeah, but it's how you identify the BMS frame. You have a group of symmetry, it's infinite dimensional, you need to, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not relativity. Anyway, it doesn't change what you're going to say. It's just that conceptually it's not, there's no, I mean, the confusion is most terminological, or it's the same confusion people add versus energy versus mass, really. It's not deeper than that. Energy is not invariant, mass is invariant. In a given frame, they agree. Anyway, it was supposed to clarify. I hope.
We cannot hear you.
Sorry, to understand what you said, but I don't think it's part of the issue is that, but I don't think that's the whole issue.
Yeah.
Maybe we can move on.
Maybe you can move on. I think conceptually it's the same. Technically, it's much more complicated. That's true.
So
please continue. Please continue.
So in this case, one can sort of quantize this differences quite explicitly. Okay, so here is the actual difference. And again, this is actually can be written in terms of how much the mass spec changes from spatial infinities to time-like infinity. And your killing field is here, your super transition is here. And again, the approach is basically, again, you have delta j in one coordinate, between this way. In the other coordinate, you have the same integral, but everything replaced with the bar. And then use, again, these. These formulas to relate them and keeping track of what's the difference. And eventually one can show that I see everything, it start with actually an integral on the whole square plot, but then everything can be integrated by part. First on somewhere on sphere and then integrate by part on U to make it as a difference of two integrals at time lag and spatial infinity and can be combined into a single integral like this. Right. So we want to find a new definition which doesn't have this ambiguities. So we will use the following approach. So we will start with sort of quasi-local angular momentum based on the theory of quasi-local mass of Wang Yao in 2009. So this is sort of a Hamiltonian approach at a quasi-local level. You use isometric embedding into the Minkowski states to identify suitable ground state. So specifically, that means associate conserved quantity to each two surface, space like two surface in a given space time to indicate the amount of the conserved quantity contained in a slide with that boundary. And the data you need is sort of the intrinsic and extrinsic curvatures, induced metric on the two sphere and also the mean curvatures and information about the connection form. Once you choose this, so first you look at a theory of quasi-local mass. For each isometric embedding into the Minkowski space, there's an assigned energy. Then you minimize among all embeddings to get the mass. Okay. And with that particular embedding that minimizes the mass, you can pull back the rotation killing field from the Minkowski space to your surface and use this to define a quasi-local angular momentum on your surface. Well, actually, three of them because they have three rotation killing fields in the Minkowski space. Okay. Now in a bounded coordinate system on a fixed U slice, then we consider two surfaces which are the level set for R, then that is level set goes to infinity. We use the limit of the quasi-local angular momentum use the limit as the angular momentum at now infinity for this U slice. So this final step, this is evaluated by Karen Wang Yao in 2 years ago now. And specifically, actually, the whole process is quite complicated, but at the end, it adds one correction term to the classical angular momentum. And this comes from sort of looking at the potential for the shear tensor. So you decompose into the closed part and the co-closed part to potential C and C bar. And in fact, the correction term involves just the closed part of the potential. So it involves C times the gradient of N and in product. So in any of the previous definition, you don't need to do this decompositions and there's no particular, this type of term doesn't show in any sort of earlier definition of angular momentum. It's also a non-local term. I mean, non-local in the sense that, CAB determine both C and C bar, but you have to solve an elliptic equation on X2 to get it. So C and C bar depend on, at each point would depend on the whole behavior of CAB on the whole S2, non-local in that sense. And once we add this correction term, then indeed under the same decay condition, the total flux is super translation invariant. As pointed out before, it means that equivariant under the L equals to one and zero mode of translation and invariant under higher mode. Go ahead.
So question on the elliptic equation, What conditions do you have to have in a single solution? Like for instance, I can have a constant added in, that would be stupid, but it would change my value down here.
Well, or is PNC bar both has the one zero mode and one mode are both, the zero mode and one modes are the ambiguities, and the one mode for C corresponds to a spatial translation. So I mean, if you want to do an isometric band into R3, you can sort of translate the sense surface in R3. So the ambiguity for C corresponds to that. And we are setting it to have a zero component in those modes.
To have zero, you say?
So the ambiguity, this would determine CNC bar that determine up to zero, the constant mode and the one mode.
Sure.
And the one mode of C corresponds to like just translate your embedding in R3.
Sure, you're setting both of them to zero. Is that what you're saying?
I'm setting both of them to zero.
Okay, thank you.
I have a related question, I guess. It was this condition, this split of C and C bar, mm-hmm. and somehow the fact that you're looking only at the higher modes, you know, bigger than two of C and C bar, this decomposition, how does it change when you make a conformal rescaling of the metric? I think that because when you make a super rotation, then you're making a conformal transformation in your metric. So does that? So C and C bar are they invariant under that boost?
You have to multiply the conformal factor.
Yeah. You have to change the conformal factor, but usually that changes the what you call mod one and mod two. So the no.
Right. So.
So C,
you will also multiply C and C bar by the same conformal factor.
Okay, so C and C bar are not invariant under the a change of.
Do a boost. Yeah, it's going to change if you do a boost.
So you have to fix that somehow. You have to fix an absolute boost frame in order to define an invariant charge. That's the assumption.
No, again,
if you have a foliation, then you have a CNC bar, I agree. But the thing is that part of the symmetry group is changing that foliation, right? The boost components. The rescaling of the metric is a change of foliation. So it means there's still this kind of ambiguity there.
Actually, when you do the, you have a rotation gap, you actually don't have a boost, because when you
by boost I mean a diffeomorphism of the sphere that changed the scale factor, that has a non area preserving transformation, if you want.
Right.
A YA which divergence does not vanish, that's what I call a boost.
Right, the boost, you know, that will be fixed in. That will be fixed in this step of the D when you minimize the. Minimize the mass.
I don't see how you can have a. So you're saying there's an absolute notion of boost frame in a. Okay, maybe that sounds surprising. But okay.
If you're talking about the boost transformation, that is something we have to deal with separately, and
Okay. So so what you're saying, if I understand properly, it's you first choose a boost frame, which is whatever it is, and then you can get rid of the super translation.
What we have is if you do a boost, then everything sort of just boost equivalently. I mean, so there's no.
It's going to change the gauge fixing of your super translation frame. That's what I'm worried about. Maybe you don't, you're not looking at it here, and that's okay.
I mean, if you do, I think you do that separately. If you do a, just do a boost, then it's going to just change everything equivalently as you would expect from special relativity even. Then you do your super translation afterward. Let's see. So more precisely, if you look at the translate of these.
The subtlety, maybe, sorry, to insist, is that you cannot ensure that you have the same boost frame initially. And it's always the same thing. It's always a relative observable. So at some point, you will have to connect the initial boost frame with the final boost frame. So
I mean, again, we fix a boundary coordinate system and we deal with that in a zero coordinate system. If you want to apply a boost, then you apply the boost transformations and we can deal with that separately.
Okay.
Specifically, I mean this in terms of a right. In fact, you sort of chill out the higher mode, and if you take the lower mode, then indeed this is going to be what you would expect from special relativity when you do a ordinary sort of space and time translations. Then your angular momentum is going to change by this much. The amount you translate cross product with the linear momentum, and since you're taking the difference of the linear momentum, that's what you would expect. But the higher mode will be invariant. But so, okay, so we'll see what this is. End of my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional questions for Pauline? Lauren, you still have your hands up. Do you still have any question or?
No, it was clapping.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe I can ask a question. I had some email exchange with by Ash Takar days ago, and he seemed to suggest that you are working in some fixed Bondi coordinate. And he let me read what he said. I don't know if you had discussion with him in the workshop. This flat asymptotopia workshop.
I think this was the sense of a question. Chen, if you show the previous slide, in fact, it was clear on the previous slide. I think it's going back to this discussion. So this, you know, this. One of the issues that the decomposition into, so the notion of harmonic mode lower than one is invariant, but the notion of harmonic mode bigger than two is not. And that's where it depends on the choice of the coordinates. So I think that's, I'm sure Abai, if you read it, it will be. So, and if I understand properly, because you need to define the invariant angular momenta, you need to fix the translation, the super translation frame, and put all these higher modes to zero. And then you define the angular momenta in that super translation frame. So I think his worry is that split is not universal, if you want. That was the sense of my questions about the boost frame.
But we are working in sort of a single boundary coordinate system, but we allow the super translation to act on that coordinate system. And GMP we are choosing is sort of with respect, in each coordinate we are choosing a GMP with respect to that boundary coordinate system. So this is how we sort of identify killing fields on on the initial and the final state. So I mean, if you don't have a single coordinate system that cover everything, then that's sort of, well, that's not.
Okay.
Something we can cover here.
So you have a fixed conformal frame at the sky, and
but again, this ambiguity will still show up in the you have two sort of coordinate both going from time-like spatial infinity to time-like infinity, and identify in the same within each coordinate, identifying in the same way, and you will still have this. Ambiguity if you do get these sort of the classical angular momentum, whereas in our case at least we can eliminate that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
What? It's important.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Right. So I can think of fixing the ambiguity of the angular momentum flux in two ways. So one is what you did, which is to change the definition. And another way of doing it is to, eliminate the ambiguity by choosing a Bondi frame that's going to be the same frame at all times. And that I can do by imposing a condition on the shear. I can, for example, choose the shear to be zero at u equals minus infinity. And that that kills the freedom to perform a super translation at any other time, and that's just a different way of fixing the ambiguity. So I cannot see. I mean, I'm trying to understand what's the disadvantage of choosing my option versus your option.
So it's killed off by. Well, so that I think it's precisely this is either zero at positive or negative infinity. Thing.
Yeah, so I'm saying that, I declare CAB to be zero at minus infinity.
Right. But, you should. Could make that choice, but there's no reason why that particular coordinate should be preferred over the other.
No, it's just preferred by me. And if I stick to my preference, then there's no trace of ambiguity, and I can do calculations, and everybody should agree with me that in my preferred frame things are well defined.
Yes, you could.
If you look at your formula, look at the formula you show, Eric. If I can chime in, they're essentially the same. And let's say if you're in group theory, it's a very well known problem. Let's say you can define the spin as being the spin in a particular frame of reference, or you can then that's Eric's definition. It's a gauge fixed formulation. Then you can construct what's called a relative observable or gauge invariant observable, which is the observable which is exactly agreeing with that definition, but which is invariant under your rotation. And if you look at your formula for the angular momenta and you choose the frame of Eric, you're going to find that they agree. And then what you did is, it's called, you're just, so once you have gauge fixing, there's always a way, a gauge fixed observable is always, can always be mapped to a gauge invariant observable.
Yeah.
I think this is essentially the essence of the construction there. And Jen, so if you show the formula for the angular momenta, right, and you apply the frame of Eric, then so I think this is the essence of the constant, right? If C is equal to zero, then that's the same formula.
Oh, if C is equal to zero.
Yeah, but that's Eric's friend. Eric is saying, well, I choose C such that it's zero on my sphere, asymptotic sphere.
Right. So in that frame, they will be, that particular frame, they will be.
Yeah. And then what you're writing here is a formula that associated to a gauge fixing gives a gauge invariant observable.
Well,
right. But you see, this is kind of different. It, if I go back to the example of the spin and the angular momenta, there's a difference between defining the spin as being the angular momenta in the frame where the mass vanish, or where the momenta vanish, the linear momenta vanish, which is G0i, or defining the Pauli-Lubansky vector, right? It's a little bit, one is a gauge fixed version, and the other one is really a Casimir of this, of the algebra. That's what I wanted to emphasize. Anyway, I mean, if Eric can comment, if you, does that make sense, Eric?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I like the way you phrased it. I mean, it's, you know, gauge invariance versus gauge fixed, and I think it's basically the same thing expressed differently.
But you may have some gauge fixed quantity, right? But that doesn't mean you have a gauge invariant version.
But there is always a gauge invariant version, yes, for sure.
For angular momentum.
What?
For angular momentum, there is always a gauge invariant version.
No, I'm thinking in general, if you have a notion of gauge symmetry and you gauge fix, then you can promote that observable, the gauge fix observable as a gauge invariant observable.
Yeah, that I agree. It seems to be a point that tends to not be understood very well. In different contexts, I mean.
Okay. Any other questions for Pauline? Okay, if not, let's thank Pauline again.
Yep. Thank you. Very nice talk.
Thank you.